The following program contains scenes and language of a frank and explicit nature. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome to Film Jitsu, the podcast that wields films as deadly weapons. We are your hosts. I am Jay.
And I am Mike.
On this, our second merry and bright holiday episode of 2025, Mike was forced to indulge in perhaps the most charismatic exercise in cinematic Christmas poor taste ever committed to celluloid by finally watching a movie he has successfully dodged for 21 consecutive holiday seasons, I think. The star-stuffed, unflinchingly wacky comedy drama, Love Actually. A film that somehow remains one of the most divisive movies of the 21st century. We'll soon find out whether Mike joins the ranks of the Love Actualists, not a real name, but one I'm desperately hoping will catch on, or if he proves himself a normal, well-adjusted human being who sees this thing for what it is, an overlong, overstuffed slab of saccharine nonsense. After hearing Mike's thoughts, we'll count down our bottom five subplots, because if there's anything Love actually is, it's a collection of background stories desperately searching for a central narrative. And then we'll wrap things up with our final round of dueling double bills for 2025, which will determine who loses and must endure a double feature that we are personally responsible for creating. And since our next episode is our year in review spectacular, the Jitsu Awards, Mike will have to wait a full week before assigning me my next cinematic rap across the knuckles. But first, let's pause and have a listen to the trailer for a movie that somehow manages to land on both top 10 Christmas films lists and worst movies ever made lists, 2003's Love Actually.
This holiday season,
I'm picking up good vibrations.
Join this unforgettable filmmaking team.
Welcome, Prime Minister. This is Natalie.
Hello, David. I mean, sir.
20 years ago, you'd have been just his type.
As they explore that time of year when desires are revealed.
I'm in love.
Aren't you the young to be in love?
No.
Oh, okay.
Secrets are exposed.
Your secretary is very pretty.
Mister.
Be careful there.
And chances are finally taken.
All I want for Christmas is you.
Universal Pictures invites you.
What's the best sex you've ever had?
Britney Spears. No, I ain't kidding. She was rubbish.
This holiday season.
Give me more joy than I ever dreamed of.
This is Natalie. Live here.
All you need.
Oh.
Hello.
Is love, actually.
Are you seeing cows?
I suppose I could.
Please, sir, please.
Good King Wenceslas looked out on the feast of Stephen when the snow lay round.
Mike, I'm just going to come out and say it. Love Actually is a bad movie. I know it's a bad movie. But it's also got one of the most insanely stacked casts I've ever seen assembled.
Mm-hmm.
And it knows exactly how to deploy most of them across its 13-ish bizarre, loosely holiday-themed storylines. Yes, it's confusing. Yes, it's overlong. Yes, it's dated. And yes, it occasionally descends into genuinely questionable taste. But Mike, I love it. And I watch it every year.
You do?
I do.
You have talked about this movie over the course of our show, and I guess I kind of always thought you were kidding. but no, you're on board, huh? This that's not a goof. You're in.
There was no better film for us to celebrate the holidays with on our Bad Movie podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And there really isn't a better target at the holidays than Love Actually.
Uh-huh.
Because whether your feelings about this movie are love, actually, or hate, actually, it was time for you to finally take a side.
Yeah. Prior to having seen the movie, I think my understanding of its reputation was that this was a movie that audiences generally love. I thought this was a kind of a well-regarded holiday film.
Oh.
And because it was so rom-commy, I wasn't really that interested.
Oh, okay.
I was wrong. It is not a good movie. But is it true, do you think, that generally speaking, audiences are more on your side than on my side? Because I think this is a movie that people do like.
So critics hate it and audiences love it. It's one of those. The cinema score is somewhere around B plus for audiences. And I think it's somewhere in the D, D minus area for critics. There's a pretty big disparity there.
So let's start then with you. Even though I reviewed the movie, explain yourself to me.
No, you're the one that's supposed to choose a side here.
Oh, I chose a side. There's side chosen.
Yeah,
but I
sure
am curious
did.
How you landed on the other side of the fence with this thing.
My wife.
Oh. Okay.
I think her affection for the film really won me over. I like Hugh Grant a lot. I loved Four Weddings and a Funeral. I liked Notting Hill. Paddington 2 is classic. What can I say?
Yeah, okay. I think my Love Actually problem is one, Hugh Grant. That for you, it's a positive. For me, it is a negative. I'm not a Hugh Grant guy. And I found this movie stressful because the way that it is set up with these just 1,000 different stories happening at the same time is I think because your brain understands what film language is, I spent so much of the beginning of this movie trying to figure out who's the main character in this movie? Who do I care about? How do these connect? I was trying to like put the pieces together in a way that I wish that the film would have just been like, this is an anthology.
Yeah.
But I found it really stressful because I felt like I was not following it properly. Like I was missing things.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, that person must be related to the person from the other scene, but how? And I don't get it.
I think that that's something that gets solved through repeated viewings. Not unlike when I first saw Big Lebowski and hated it because I didn't understand what the fuck was going on.
Right.
Love Actually was the same exact thing. But the second time when I went in, I knew what was happening and I understood how the stories went and I knew where the moments were that I liked it. The third time, it became almost ceremonial. And then the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and it just every year. Yeah.
Oh, so much schmaltz. I will tell you that I was all the fuck the way out on Love Actually at the All You Need Is Love flash mob scene 5 minutes into the movie. I was like, nope, I'm good. This is not for me.
I don't even remember that.
The wedding happens. Keira Knightley and Chiwetel Ejiofor, they get married and Andrew Lincoln throws this surprise.
Yes. Look, yes.
If anybody had ever dared throw a flash mob at my wedding, there would have been hell to pay. Fair. What a ballsy move that is to just hijack somebody's wedding.
That's what you do when you're in love with the bride.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Jesus. But I found this entire thing exhausting. It was like getting dragged to a holiday party that you absolutely don't want to go to.
Yeah.
Only I wasn't able to get drunk at home before the party to take the edge off.
I want to remind you and the audience of what you gave me for my Christmas present.
Yeah, what was it?
Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure.
Yeah, I don't see the problem.
Yeah. What's the problem there? So yeah, you're exhausted. Yeah. Oh, poor you. My heart really breaks, Mike.
Exciting news.
What?
I've bought a ticket to the States. I'm off in 3 weeks.
No.
Yes. To a fantastic place called Wisconsin.
No.
Yes, Wisconsin, babes. Here comes Sir Colin.
No. There are a few babes in America, I grant you. But they're already going out with rich, attractive guys.
Now, Tone, you're just jealous. You know perfectly well that any bar, anywhere in America, contains 10 girls more beautiful and more likely to have sex with me than the whole of the United Kingdom.
That is total bollocks.
Finally, the movie ends in this, like, 10-car pileup on the highway of a final scene where all of the characters somehow end up at the airport at the same time.
Yes.
And now we get to find out that, like, that's the sister or the brother or that guy who knows him from the whatever.
But the very beginning of the movie takes place, and it has this really great opening scene where they talk about all of the emotion and the love that happens at an airport.
Mm-hmm.
I love the cyclical nature of that, the bookends that that movie provides. And I love that we follow all these disparate stories and then they come back together at the airport. I don't think that enough credit's given to that structure, and I like it a lot.
I did think the opening and closing where they had footage of real like airport reunions, I actually was quite charmed by
me too.
By the those moments. I am a sucker for that kind of thing. You want to make me cry, Jason? Have a guy from the military come home and his dog sees him for the first time in a couple of years. That's how you make me cry. That's every time. Just every time.
But of course, nothing else in the rest of the movie is that genuine, right?
As no,
that
level. Not at all.
It's a very
not
cynical film. A lot of the sense of humor is really dark, which really appeals to me, I think, in my sensibilities.
Okay, yeah. I can see why this movie appeals to you.
It's really walking a tightrope between schmaltzy and heartfelt and real and utterly ridiculous and cynical. And somehow for me, it does strike this balance with Bill Nighy and his pop chart topping Christmases All Around, which makes it to the top of the charts just because they want to see an old guy naked on TV.
Mm-hmm.
From that all the way to Hugh Grant falling in love with the quote unquote chubby. I don't know.
Why are there so many weird fat jokes in this movie? What is they call somebody Miss Dunkin' Donuts 2003.
Yes.
I was what is all the fat shaming in Love Actually?
She's not even big either on top of
nobody in this movie
She's
is a big
gloriously
person.
Beautiful. But anyway.
Yeah, everybody in this movie is gloriously beautiful. And that's
Alan
not a bad
Rickman's
thing.
Alan Rickman sporting some questionable hair.
The hair is the hair
got,
is something.
He's got some Nicolas Cage happening there.
I will say Emma Thompson is the only watchable thing in this entire
give
movie
me
for
a
me.
Break. The only.
No, I thought she was wonderful.
This is
wonderful.
The guy that doesn't talk in absolutes, and he's like, the only.
I couldn't stand any other part of this.
You are absurd.
I do take that back. I found the Martin Freeman lighting doubles bit really quite cute and charming.
Oh my God, that is my least favorite.
I found it a little bit cute and charming.
You are an alien to me. I don't even understand you.
I might be.
That is, oh God. Is it because Martin Freeman turned into like a big thing after this and now you like have an appreciation for him? Or
no, I just found it so random and cute and kind of a big swing in a movie to be like, we're going to have naked characters humping.
That's the cynicism. That's part of
it. I know what lighting doubles are.
Yeah.
But I wonder, like, my grandma wouldn't know what a lighting double was. So I can only imagine how many people are watching this movie and like, they're not stunt doubles. Like, what is happening? I don't know. There was something so offbeat and weird about it that I was kind of like, this is the kind of weird shit that Marion gets into.
Jesus.
But here's what's up. Just pick a fucking story and make that movie.
No.
And this is where it falls apart for me because every single one of these things, I actually, if they fleshed it out and made a full movie out of any one of these stories, I could be into it. I really could. And in fact, because you know I love a good exercise and a good challenge, I went ahead and took a moment to try to figure out how would I turn each of these stories into a full feature by giving it maybe a different director and the full treatment. So the Colin Firth and Sienna Guillory who fall in love and are kept apart by a language barrier, that one.
Yes, Portuguese, yeah.
Easy for me. Richard Linklater doing this story's version of Before Sunrise, a bittersweet love story about two people from different worlds kind of falling in love and things end with a smile. I would love
Sounds
to see
painful.
That story done by Richard Linklater. The Laura Linney, Rodrigo Santoro, and her brother for some reason one.
That's a tough one. Yep. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Here, I would go with director Sarah Polley, who's best known for making gorgeous films about complicated family relationships.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's good.
Away from her stories we tell, there's an actual movie.
That's solid.
Colin, who goes to America to get laid.
Yeah, what's this one?
This is an early aughts sex comedy that is best directed by a pre-Joker Todd Phillips, right? Think The Hangover and Old School and that kind of
thing. That's quality.
That's one's good. Keira Knightley, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Andrew Lincoln. By the way, this movie, how you waste an actor like Chiwetel Ejiofor by just having him be in your movie but not act in your movie is just unforgivable.
He's just there.
But this weird one, which I think this is the story that most people turn their nose up at. This is not aged well. It's gotten real
weird,
right?
This is the one that people are like,
So for me, this should be the twisted erotic thriller that this plot actually demands. And I'm actually assigning this story to Jeremiah Chichek.
Oh.
Because, of course, he directed Christmas Vacation, and but Diabolique. Also Diabolique with Sharon Stone and Isabella Gianni. So I like the Christmas erotic thriller crossover here. So that gets the nod
Barbette
for me.
I thought Schroeder, the one that did Single White Female, but hey, teach his own.
I thought about a few. Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson, that story was the only one that I didn't hate. So let's put some meat on the bone
Richard
here. And
Curtis
just,
can actually direct that one. He can keep that one himself.
What I would actually like to do with that story is I would like to Manchester by the Sea this motherfucker and give it to Kenneth Lonergan and just like, let's really go all in on this messed up marriage.
Oh, that's that's so overwrought. Too much.
I'll take it. I will take it.
Full stories like of these little vignettes. Their vignettes.
Yeah. But I'm more interested. I couldn't get interested in any of these little tastes.
My God, you crazy man. Keep going with this. I want to hear the rest.
The Martin Freeman and Joanna Page, the lighting doubles thing. Yeah. Again, super easy. I'm giving that one to Kevin Smith, kind of a Zach and Miri.
Oh my God. That's
like
so good.
Like a raunch comedy kind of thing.
That's
for
really,
sure.
really good, Mike.
And that then is. The last one, the Hugh Grant bit. I'm very clearly going to give that to Gary Marshall, and we're going to do the Pretty Woman treatment.
The same Gary Marshall that ended up taking this formula and making three movies up until the very end of his life that followed this template, that Gary Marshall.
That's the one.
But circa Pretty Woman, not
Pretty
circa
Woman. Yeah,
New
I want
Year's.
Him to do the Pretty Woman thing.
Daniel! I have a plan.
Thank the Lord. Tell me.
Well, girls love musicians, don't they?
Uh-huh.
Even the really weird ones get girlfriends.
That's right. Meatloaf definitely got laid at least once, for God's sake. Ringo Starr married a Bond girl.
Whatever. There's this big concert at the end of term, and Joanna's in it. And I thought maybe if I was in the band and played absolutely superbly, there's a chance that she might actually fall in love with me. What do you think?
I think it's brilliant. I think it's stellar. Apart from the one obvious tiny little baby, little hiccup.
They don't play musical instrument.
Yes, sir.
A tiny, insignificant detail.
What happens to Liam Neeson in all this? Where's Liam Neeson and his kid?
The Liam Neeson bit I did find charming. I thought he was easy to like in that one.
Very.
What I would actually do with this is I would do, and it's weird because it's a Hugh Grant crossover. When Hugh Grant did About a Boy, where it was Hugh Grant and a, you know, the young boy, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Chris and Paul Weitz directed those.
Okay.
Directed that film. I would watch that because it would be a little less schmaltzy, but I did like the dynamic between the boy and the adult. That one was
Or you could just watch Big Daddy, I guess, if you really wanted.
Yeah, what I did sort of like about that bit is, for some reason that I can't quite articulate, the Liam Neeson story was almost like the connected thread.
It is.
Through all of it, where like when I wasn't enjoying the other stories, this one would pop up and give me a little bit more.
That's right.
And I really did like it. I liked the way that he talked to the boy in an adult way, you know, when he was just like straightforward with them about sex and women and how.
And Claudia Schiffer.
And Claudia Schiffer, who shows up in the movie, which I did think was a nice touch. And I did like that what was behind all of that, but it wasn't too ham-fisted, was this was the stepfather.
Yeah, I know. I love that. As a guy who grew up raised by his stepdad, that meant a huge amount to me.
I just really appreciated that the movie didn't force that down your throat.
Yeah.
They had lost the mother. And they set up that dynamic, and then you watch this guy in a very unconventional way win over this boy's love by just listening to him and taking him seriously.
And taking him seriously, yeah. Such a huge thing.
And I thought that was great. And it actually, all joking aside, it reminded me of you. Because I have seen you take that approach with your own boys. Like, you you have a relationship with your boys where you have never treated them exactly their age, right?
Yeah, probably not. Yeah. It just took the whole family to The Shining and IMAX. Right. So, yeah.
You have always kind of taken that approach with your kids, which is, I think, why they've turned out to be interesting, awesome little dudes. And so that bit I was into because it reminded me of my buddy Jason a little bit.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
So I found moments like I try to do in anything. I tried to find a couple of things to hang my hat on and a couple of things to enjoy. I did find the Andrew Lincoln Keira Knightley story deeply weird.
It's pretty weird. I think that if you were raised, I'm a little older than you by about 70 or 80 years. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that age gap that we have, I genuinely think that there's a line between stalker and romantic that on my side of the fence, it's less stalkerish and more romantic. And on your side of the fence, it's more stalkerish and not romantic.
The 80s didn't believe in stalking or boundaries. They found it to be romantic. I do think the hand wringing over it is a little over the top. Is it weird? Is it inappropriate? Sure. He doesn't pursue her. He tries to keep a boundary. Like, he feels the way that he feels.
Right, exactly.
And even in the infamous scene with the poster boards, right?
Which they almost cut.
Yeah. One of those says, without hope or agenda, I think something like that.
That's
He's just
correct.
Expressing himself.
I love that.
And she chases him out into the street, right?
Right,
I mean,
she
does. So,
but it wasn't even like these two were going to have a romantic relationship.
Right.
It was almost to say that there's a little bit of Christmas magic that for a moment something can happen and then it'll go back to whatever. And I don't believe that Keira Knightley didn't love Chiwetel Ejiofor, but I do think that in that moment, she was so swooned by Andrew Lincoln's
affection.
Pure
because
affection.
She thought he didn't like her at all. She was worried that he didn't like her at all.
But then she figured it out and from the videotape and everything. Right. And she was like, oh. And it didn't seem stalkerish to me. It seemed appreciative.
No, it didn't to me either. It seemed inappropriate to me. That's where I landed.
Well, you want to know why it's inappropriate? She was 18 years old when they filmed it.
Oh, really?
Chiwetel Ejiofor, 26 years old.
Something I did find out when I did a little reading up on it is that she was only 5 years older than the little boy from the Liam Neeson bit. That's crazy to me.
She's closer in age to the little boy than she is to her husband.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the kind of weirdness that permeates this film. There's that cynicism, but then there's love and care and thoughtfulness and nostalgia and all this stuff kind of happening all at once. And that's life. And I find the whimsy in this sort of very adult, sometimes in bad taste, some of the jokes, some of the things. Emma Thompson says some really pretty fucked up shit to her brother as he's mourning his dead wife. You know, she says some pretty stern stuff.
They have that weird relationship. Yeah, no, like nobody's ever going to shag you if you don't stop crying, something like that.
I'm sorry, they're not brother and sister. She's actually sister to
Hugh Grant.
But
they're friends.
Prime Minister.
They know each
other. They're buddies. Yeah, they're buddies. The Rickman-Emma Thompson relationship piece is the most powerful piece of the film.
Because she's such a great actress.
Well, she was drawing on the stuff that happened to her with Kenneth Branagh. That was real.
Yeah, she brings life to that. And I think this is kind of my complaint overall, is that just when I started to get invested in any one of these stories, the movie would balk and cut me over to something else. This is why, like, I would love to watch a full story of Emma Thompson and her husband and this marriage. I would be into that.
It's all there. You don't need any interstitial scenes. It's all in this film. I just think you need to watch it again. Not that you ever will.
Well,
but
maybe. But here's the thing for me. I know that the acts are there. Somehow, and this is, you could do the math on this. We have about 100 stories that all somehow managed to have a three-act structure in each one of them, right?
That's
so we got
true.
900 acts. So you're right. It is all there in how you tell a story.
Right.
But for me, I could never get emotionally invested in what was going on because it would cut away.
For me, it's the complete opposite. It gets you hooked. You have it in your memory, in your RAM. You pick up another story, you put that one in your RAM, and then you come back to the other one. You spin up that drive again because, we're moving forward with that one now. And I love that it's almost like a Victorian novel in some ways, the interweavings of these different narratives and these little vignettes as they play out. And I love the brazenness. The more I see that film, the more I appreciate the structure, truthfully. Yeah. And I do think that there's a lot of really whack job kind of stuff. The Bill Nighy thing is completely bonkers, right? It's nuts. But at the center of it is a platonic relationship between two friends that I absolutely adore.
You mean that they just mention in the last 15 seconds of that vignette? There is no hint anywhere in that story.
It is there. It's
that
there.
That he cares about that guy at all. Certainly not in that way. And I would
not in that way. I think he comes to a conclusion seeing the devotion that we see all throughout the film. He sees it. He learns it. And then we get to have that good feeling of him arriving where we already were.
I felt like that was totally out of left field for that character.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all.
He doesn't give him a lick of attention. There's one line in there where he talks about spending Christmas with his fat manager, which again, why is there another fat joke here? And then at the end, seemingly out of nowhere, he's like, by the way, you're the love of my life. And I was like, where was that in anywhere else in this story?
Loved it.
Nope, not for me. And so here's what I will say.
Okay.
What I've heard from you repeatedly today
is
that one watch is insufficient.
Yes, it is.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
I will watch it with my wife, and I'll watch it again, and I will give it a fair shot. I really will. I wanted to like some of this stuff.
But I don't mind that you don't, because I think that, to be fair, I see all the flaws in this film.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm only talking from the standpoint of a longtime fan of this foolishness.
Yeah.
But I'm thoroughly aware that this is not a particularly good film. Your viewpoint is 100% valid. When I showed this to Justin Tiberius Santo, his response was 100% your response. Mm. He was alienated by the film.
But I'm willing to be won over. I'm willing to watch it again because the one thing that you have made very clear is that if I'm going to eat the meal, I have to eat the meal the right way. You know what I mean?
Fair enough.
And
that's
so
cool.
That's what I'm going to try to do with Love Actually.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So for this week's bottom five, we're counting down our bottom five subplots, which felt especially appropriate given that our main review is Love Actually, a movie that is essentially nothing but subplots. What I was looking for were subplots that don't support the main story. They don't deepen the themes, and they don't even really run alongside the movie. They sort of hijack it. That's my way of going with this. So with that in mind, what was your approach, Mike? And what is your number five?
I thought about it a little bit differently in that it didn't have to hijack the movie for me. If anything, it had to be like this alien invader that was somehow happening while the rest of the movie was going on. And you were like, why?
That's real similar.
I think for me. So it didn't have to necessarily hijack or transform the movie.
Okay.
And there are so many. Even I was thinking about an earlier episode when we watched Cool as Ice. And just for some reason, the dad
that's
was in the
right.
witness protection program. Like, wait, what?
What?
Why?
Yeah,
the bad guys are choice. That sort of thing. That sort of thing.
Well, but no, I think we are thinking of it the same way. We're just using slightly different terminology, maybe. I mean.
And so my number five is actually an example of a larger common subplot problem that I have.
Yep.
I really cannot stand completely unnecessary romantic subplots in a movie that don't need
We're going to have a similar number five.
Okay. So my example for this, though, is probably not what you were expecting.
Okay.
In this one, it's the romantic subplot in the Pixar film Ratatouille between Alfredo, the dorky chef, and Colette, the stern but compassionate sous chef who's showing him the ropes in the kitchen. No one gives a shit about Alfredo the human in Ratatouille. Do you know how I know that no one gives a shit, Jason? Do you know how I can prove that to you?
Because his name isn't Alfredo, is it?
That's right. It's Linguini, and I bet half of the people didn't even notice.
Oh, all right. Because I was like, what is he talking about?
Yeah, nobody cares about
that movie, but I knew that was wrong.
Nobody cares about that guy. Linguini is the boring human that Remy drives around like a razor scooter. It isn't Linguini's movie. I don't care what happens to him. I especially don't care if his hard-ass but compassionate boss from the kitchen thinks he's cute or not. Not every movie needs a romance subplot. And it's this true. Animated A Rat Likes to Cook movie is a great example of that.
I thought you were different. I thought you thought I was different. I thought...
I didn't have to help you. If I looked out only for myself, I would have let you drown. But I wanted you to succeed. I liked you. My mistake.
Colette. Wait. Colette! Oh, it's over, little chef. I can't do it anymore.
There are a lot of fun subplots in Ratatouille. There's Remy's father not approving of his love of the human world. There's Chef Skinner selling out the restaurant brand for big box stores. There's all the Anton Ego stuff. Linguini's love life is just a layer in this wonderful little movie that could have been left out entirely, and it wouldn't have mattered at all. So Ratatouille, my number five.
Same reason for my number five, the Crowbar Inn romance that nobody asked for, Planet of the Apes. 1968. Now, Franklin J. Schaffner's film is one of the sharpest, most savage science fiction allegories ever put on screen. Mm. A film about power, language, dehumanization, and the terrifying fragility of civilization itself, which makes it all the more baffling that it pauses to saddle Charlton Heston's Taylor with Nova, a mute human companion who exists largely as an emotional ballast and implied romantic pairing, because they don't really get it on, so to speak. But it's the subplot isn't explicit, but it's unmistakable.
Mm-hmm.
Nova's framed as Taylor's partner, prize, and tether to humanity. Stripped of language and agency, she won't complicate any of the film's ideas.
Uh-huh.
So it adds nothing to the satire. It undercuts the movie's critique of hierarchies. And it feels like a studio mandate born of a belief that in even the bleakest sci-fi parable, you still need a girl for the hero.
Uh-huh.
The film didn't need it. And that's exactly why it makes the list. Just like you. I love that our number fives were so similar. What is your number four?
My number four is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom from 2018.
Oh my God, dinosaurs in the basement. This movie in my house.
You like Fallen Kingdom?
Yeah, that's the one with the dinosaurs in the basement. The one that's directed by J.A. Bayona, right?
The one that five fucking movies into the franchise, and now we introduced a clone child subplot with enormous ethical implications, then mostly ignore it.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, that's the problem here. Yes.
Yeah, that happens.
We're talking about little Maisie, who we find out isn't a real human, but is actually a DNA clone of the dead daughter of John Lockwood, a project that made John Hammond end their partnership way back when, yada, 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 this franchise is a mess. And that's it. Back to the fucking dinosaurs. Are you kidding me? This movie introduces the most consequential scientific breakthrough in the history of recorded humanity. So obviously that's what this whole movie is about, right? The ethical, ecclesiastical implications of cloning a deceased human. Nope. We're just right back to exploding dinosaurs on a volcano island. That's it.
Yeah.
This clone daughter plot should be the most important thing that's ever happened on planet Earth. And the movie has no idea what to do with that fact. And so it just makes the bold and brave choice to shove it into the narrative junk drawer and just kind of not deal with it and just like release the dinosaurs and watch all the cash roll back in. I was like, did anybody else see that? Like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
It's so you mention it. Oh, I do not remember it at all.
That's
so,
exactly right. Because there's a clone human in there. And the movie's like, oh, we made a clone human subplot. Shit, what do we do? Just like, forget it. They won't remember it.
Well, they're right.
What are you doing? The franchise is such a mess at this point. It's such a mess. And so that's why it's my number four.
My number four is a movie that we've talked about before, we may not want to talk about anymore, I'm not sure. It seems to be coming up a lot in my mind recently because of Welcome to Derry that we're watching on Max right now, my son and I. So we've just watched both the 1990 miniseries It and the films It 1 and It Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. It Chapter 2 has not one, but like seven subplots, really, that work. This sort of when trauma becomes a fetch quest sort of section of the movie.
Yeah,
it's such an example, this sequel by Andy Muschietti. It's such an example of sprawl and bloat and repetition. And mm-hmm. the core problem is that this subplot structure turns these kids' trauma that they had, they're adult characters now, but their trauma that they had as kids, into a series of these interchangeable side missions that you get. And each adult loser is sent off to confront these personal fear vignettes that neither escalate the threat nor deepen their characters in any meaningful way mm-hmm. because we already see them terrorized in the first movie.
Right. Yep.
So instead of really tightening the screws on Pennywise, the movie repeatedly pauses to remind us of the backstories that we've already seen. Critics and audiences alike noted that the film becomes less scary the longer it runs, which is a rare feat for a horror sequel with a massive budget and an iconic villain. Like, what are we doing here? When your monster keeps getting sidelined by narrative busy work, something has gone really, really wrong. Mm-hmm. So my number four is It Chapter 2 from 2019.
Almost the whole movie.
Almost
not even a specific subplot.
It's pretty much the entire second act, I think.
Right. Well done, sir.
Thank
for
you.
For sure. I may have also mentioned my number three before for different reasons at different times, but sometimes something is just so objectively correct that you have to mention it again. The Day After Tomorrow.
Oh, boy, we do hit this one a lot.
It's the end of the entire world in a cataclysmic environmental disaster. And now the fucking wolves got out? Are you kidding me? Really?
The fucking
wolves. We have
wolves.
A movie all about the Earth being plunged into a new ice age. There are sick kids trapped in a hospital. That's a subplot that makes some sense to me. Scientists are trying to save the world. Of course they were. Super cold atmospheric air is about to freeze high school students solid. And because that's somehow not enough, the wolves from the Central Park Zoo get out and try to eat our heroes.
And the wolves came.
Oh my God, the fucking wolves. The only reason it's not higher on my list is because it's the Roland Emmerichiest kind of stupid ass subplot possible.
Big time.
It's just idiotic enough to be fun. And as bad as it is, this one makes me laugh. And so the wolves escaping the zoo during the end of the world snowpocalypse is my number three.
In a perfect world, I would be in the kitchen on some sort of holiday making cookies or banana bread or something like that. And my kids would be in the other room and I would hear them watching The Day After Tomorrow and I would yell to them from the kitchen, "Oh, let me know when the wolves come."
Exactly. Yeah. Let me know when the wolves get out.
Who let the wolves out?
And they're chasing Jake Gyllenhaal on a Russian tanker as he's trying to find insulin for his dying friend. Like,
I know.
We got subplots inside of subplots inside of subplots.
The stakes are so high there. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Eventually, in just like a infinite monkeys, infinite typewriters kind of way, the wolves also got out. I love it. So that's why it's my number three. It's a terrible subplot, but it makes me laugh. And so it's number three on my list.
My number three is a similar film in that it is one of those big all-star epic disaster movies.
Okay.
But this one is one of the original set. From 1972, The Poseidon Adventure, where the romantic soap opera is in the middle of just Math's death. Irwin Allen's disaster classic flips a luxury liner upside down and strands passengers in a hellscape of fire, flooding, and structural collapse. It's such a terrific premise, immediately undermined by the film's insistence on servicing melodramatic relationship subplots that feel ripped from a daytime soap opera. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, while your ship is upside down in the ocean.
Somehow we have time for this ship.
Okay, movie. Yeah.
The most egregious offender of this is, and I just want you to, Ernest Borgnine and Stella Stevens' marital redemption arc, which plays at maximum volume while people are actively dying around them.
Oh my God.
Instead of sharpening the stakes, this subplot becomes a tonal intrusion. It repeatedly stops the survival narrative cold. This was a hallmark of 70s disaster cinema. Mm-hmm. You get the star contracts demanding that they have arcs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Poseidon remains one of the clearest examples of human drama drowning out the disaster itself.
Noted Lothario, Ernest Borgnine.
Ernest Borgnine.
All right, that does it. I'm going to go through and find out what happened.
Oh, no, you're not. You'll drown, too.
Let me go, Mr. Rogos. My wife.
Let him go, Mike.
No way. I'm going through. Now, all of you, stay put until I come back. Give me that flashlight.
Mike, please.
Take it easy, baby. I'll be back.
Wow, good. Well, maybe we were both onto something here, because my number two also involves a big old boat. My number two is anything to do with the treasure hunters taking old ass Rose and her priceless Heart of the Ocean necklace back to the site where the Titanic sank.
Titanic. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Who possibly gives a shit about this? We're supposed to get caught up in the idea that this woman has been stashing away a giant priceless necklace for 85 years and then pitches it into the ocean because of a random Titanic Tinder hookup she had on a cruise ship in her 20s. She didn't even know that guy's middle name, Jason, but I have to hear her tell Bill Paxton the whole sordid tale in 1997 for some reason. I'm all set. I'm all set.
Okay. All right.
And I guess also in this version of 1997, they must have also just cured cancer and solved world hunger, because Rose is just completely fine to toss this enormous fortune into the bottom of the ocean for like the love of the game or whatever. She's like, you can't pour one out for the homies if that means dumping a saving an orphanage amount of money into the ocean. That's insane. And then, because Bill Paxton had to listen to this whole like taxi cab confessions, Titanic edition the whole time, he's like touched by this moment and agrees that he's going to stop looking for the necklace.
Bill Paxton is awful in that movie.
Of course, awful. Because he's got nothing to do, because he's just like a chump that an old lady has conned for a free boat ride, which she didn't need, because we know that Rose has lived this privileged life.
Yeah,
she's a monster, sir. This character is a monster. Yep, that's my number two.
My number two is another one that we don't mention this particular one. We've mentioned this filmmaker. We've mentioned the movie that comes after it, which I'm not allowed to talk about anymore. Mm. But we haven't really mentioned this one. It's Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice from 2016. Zack Snyder stuffed this thing with so many ideas about power and fear and mythic symbolism, but nothing exemplifies its structural collapse quite like Lex Luthor's decision to unleash Doomsday as a backup plan. Mm-hmm. So it's loosely cribbed from the Death of Superman comics. Doomsday here isn't the point. He's like an escape hatch. Lex's manipulation of public opinion and orchestration of the Batman-Superman conflict worked. It already was successful. The movie has peaked. And then suddenly, a gray CGI monster shows up because the studio wants to kill Superman and move the chess pieces toward Justice League, the movie I can't talk about. The result is a legendary comic book storyline reduced to a third act obligation, hijacking the movie's themes and turning its climax into franchise maintenance instead of drama. I hate this fucking movie. Despise it. It is the rape of DC IP. It is absolutely the pinnacle greed and abject stupidity. And when they introduce Doomsday, thankfully, I wasn't in a theater, because I would have thrown my Dr. Pepper at the screen.
I think that Zack Snyder himself, and thus his entire body of work, is in the Hall of Lame. I think we outlawed all
of
him.
Oh, we can't even mention him now?
It's the holidays. We're all miserable. So we're going to let it slide this time. But I think that he and his entire body of work has been placed into the Hall of Lamps.
How can we not talk about that subplot?
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
It's the third. No, it's like a fourth act. I don't even know. It doesn't even make sense.
Nothing about that one makes sense. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, Jay, my number one.
Yeah.
We're just going to go ahead and roll the clip.
Oh.
Everything goes wrong at once. Nobody wants to help me, and I'm dying.
You're not dying, Mom.
I got the results of the test back. I definitely have breast cancer.
This is the definitive answer.
This the definitive answer, Jay. An enormous life-altering subplot is never seen or heard from again. Have we done an entire review of this movie? Sure. But it is just like a cornucopia of this kind of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
You could pick one of a billion probably from this movie that
how's your sex life?
Right. But this is the one. This is the one that is outrageously random.
Yeah.
It had to be number one on my list. Yeah. So
that's such a good one.
Mm-hmm, that's the one for me.
Mine comes from a movie I actually really liked when I was much younger, directed by one of my heroes. Leonard Nimoy's wildly successful remake of the French farce, Three Men in a Cradle, called Three Men and a Baby from 1987, is remembered as a warm and genial comedy about reluctant bachelors discovering parenthood. It is also inexplicably about drug dealers, stolen heroin, and hitmen firing guns inside of a Manhattan apartment full of baby furniture. While the crime subplot at least fits the absurdist tone of the French original, its near verbatim import into the Hollywood remake is astonishingly off-key. Every time the movie threatens to settle into cozy charm, it slams into genre whiplash because nothing says heartfelt yuppie comedy more than violent criminals looking for narcotics behind the changing table.
I don't remember any of this.
Yes, nobody does.
Wow.
It's the real deal.
Huh.
Even contemporary critics flagged this as baffling.
Right.
And decades later, it remains one of the most tone-deaf subplot choices in mainstream studio comedy history.
Sunday morning, I come back from jogging to find this basket with this baby in it, waiting in the vestibule.
What?
Inside is a little note from a Sylvia saying that the baby was yours and she was leaving it here for you to deal with it.
Mine?
Then along comes another little package with your name on it, only this time the package has heroin in it and the narcotics squad permanently camped downstairs knows all about it.
The cops? I don't believe this. I don't know anything about any drugs or any police. I mean, I thought I was just doing a favor for Paul. I didn't know it was in that package. And I certainly don't know anything about that baby. I mean, for God's sake, somebody drops a baby off on your doorstep and you automatically assume he's mine?
I just remembered all the adorable baby stuff.
Plays well in France, doesn't play well in the United States with Ted Danson and Tom Selleck. So there you go.
Well, certainly if our listeners have a favorite subplot, this is things people always have kind of like a pet subplot that drives them crazy.
The one.
From a movie. Yep. Everybody's got the one. For me, it's definitely the wolves. Everybody's got kind of their go-to for this one. We would love to hear from you. So please reach out to us on the socials through the emails that Jason knows about. Send me a text. Leave me a voicemail. Tell my brother. He'll tell me at Christmas. However it works. Yeah, I don't care.
However it works.
We want to know, what is your bottom five subplot? Jason, I think we're at the biggest moment of our calendar year.
Yeah,
the stakes have never been higher.
No.
I've been hydrating. I've been stretching. I've been giving myself positive affirmations. You got this, right? I have a vision board. I've been trying to just imagine what a victory looks like to manifest it.
Same here.
Because here we are, right?
Our final matchup. We're at a dead heat in Dueling Double Bills right now. The game that Mike and I play on just about every episode, where we are randomly given two titles of films that are somewhat related to the theme of the show, and then have to come up with double features with those two titles. If one of us gets 2 points in this one, that's it. That guy wins. And the other guy has to watch one of these awful double bills that we put together. I believe we decided that, like, if you were to win, you could decide what I watch out of the double bills.
Yes.
You can decide it. However, if we end up at a tie again, then the listeners get to pick one of our double bills for each one of us.
Right.
Then we will have to review two movies ourselves on future episodes. Good heavens. So that's the stakes. This is where we're at. I've got to fire up the old movie generator and let's see what we get as our first randomly generated title for Dueling Double Bills. The suspense is killing me. What's it going to be? It took one of my favorites.
What is it?
It's The Holiday from 2006.
Oh, boy.
The one with Kate Winslet, Jack Black, Cameron Diaz.
Is it they switch houses or something?
Yeah, they switch houses. It's a great flick.
Okay.
It's currently Carmen's favorite holiday flick. And it's Nancy Myers, I think, is the one that did it. I don't know what to do. I mean, the movie that I pair with this every single year is Love Actually. I don't know what else I would do.
All right.
I seem to be somewhat hobbled by reality right now. So,
okay.
Let's go ahead and get our second title now. Oh, Mike, you're going to love this one.
Okay.
Gremlins.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Yeah, that's as good as it gets.
Wow. As good as it gets.
Oh, no. As good as it gets. Oh, no. It goes so good with The Holiday. No. Oh, my God. No. My brain does this. No, I can't do it. I've already announced it. It can't be used.
All right. So The Holiday and Gremlins.
I have mine. I don't love them.
I have mine and I do.
Well, since you're happy with yours, why don't you give me the one that you are pairing with The Holiday?
I am pairing The Holiday with Notting Hill.
The fame thing isn't really real, you know. And don't forget, I'm also just a girl standing in front of a boy, asking him to love her.
Very similar. Yeah, I could see that working.
Yep.
I think I one-upped you.
The cozy vibes. Right.
Yeah.
Charming, the relationships, the sort of the different things.
Yep.
You love Notting Hill. You love Notting Hill.
I like Notting Hill.
You love Notting Hill.
I love Sleepless in Seattle.
You've talked about it so much.
And The Holiday and Sleepless in Seattle are actually a better pairing. You know why? Because they both have parallel romance storylines that happen. And then at the end, they sort of all come together. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't fall in love so much as like revolve around one another.
Okay.
And in this case, I actually took your approach. I thought about what would look good on a marquee and what kind of movie draws people in. And I see Sleepless in Seattle and The Holiday as being a pairing that would draw people in, not unlike the way Notting Hill and The Holiday would draw people in. Very similar drawing power in both of those.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's a... They're both tight.
What I liked about this Notting Hill thing is I think I appreciate the, like, they're closer together in time, so the vibes kind of work. Like, Sleepless in Seattle is very early 90s for me. I think there's a little bit, like, one is, you know, kind of that, there's a lot of suits and shit. I feel like, for me, The Holiday is a little bit more, like, cozy, cup of coffee, crackle and fire.
I think that's true.
Tonally, vibes-wise, they matched a little bit better for me, but I think I get what you're saying.
Yeah. I think that the plot construction piece of it works really well in mine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the vibe works better in yours.
Mm.
I think at the end of the day, you probably go more with vibe. So I'm going to give you that one.
You sure you don't want to come back? We don't have to decide. We can come back.
No. I don't need to. Yeah. I think you won that one. And then the next one, what did you do for Gremlins?
This one, I think, was a little bit of a no-brainer for me.
I think it's the same as me.
Did you do Edward Scissorhands?
Oh, no, I didn't. No.
I did Edward okay. Scissorhands. There's a love story. It's got all of those winter themes and you know, all of that kind of stuff. Yep. They're both Christmas movies, but kind of Christmas movies, that sort of thing. So, and I think the audiences would definitely show up for that sort of a double bill. So that one was an easy pairing for me, the Gremlins and Edward Scissorhands.
It is. And mine definitely was even more obvious and will frustrate the shit out of you because you hate this. But mine was made for the Die Hard is a Christmas movie crowd. Mm-hmm. Die Hard and Gremlins, the Christmas movies that aren't actually Christmas movies, paired up with each other, put on a marquee. Everybody loves Die Hard. Everybody loves Gremlins.
Yeah.
Very easy to see that. And it's the anti-Christmas Christmas movie crowd.
It's funny because
this is my favorite Christmas movie. It's bullshit. I don't even believe it.
Yeah.
But it is. It's the kind of thing that would attract that person.
I don't cut a bristle at somebody saying that Gremlins is a Christmas movie the way that I do with Die Hard.
I get it the same because, no, it's not a Christmas movie. It's a movie that's set at Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's two very different things, just like Die Hard.
So here's what I think I want to do. I like both of these pairings in equal measure. And I'm not prepared to say I like mine better than yours or yours better than mine in this particular one. Unless you feel very strongly about it, one way or the other.
I do. I actually really like mine better than the Edward Scissorhands matchup.
All right. Then I'll give it to you.
I like what you're doing. I like the winter theme. I think it works. I think that mine solidly addresses a solid theme that binds these two films together.
Sure. When I think about the audiences for these films, right, like Gremlins, I do think of as more of a family film. I would take my 9-year-old to Gremlins, but I don't know that I'd have her hang around for Die Hard.
Yeah, right.
So there is a little bit of that. I like them both, but I'm happy.
I don't see Gremlins as a family film, mostly because, like, I'm still trying to uphold the myth of Santa a little bit, and that movie kind of squashes that in a pretty major way. Die Hard's just so fucking ridiculous. Like, it's absurd.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have brought my kids to this anyways
because
my kids aren't little assholes.
Yeah.
You and I both hate that mentality. But this is not programmed for me and you.
Right.
And this is programmed for a wide swath of the movie going community. Yeah, sure. So
I am happy to split the difference, sir.
Oh,
and
Christ.
So here we are. I think we knew this was going to happen. It feels like it was inevitable.
It does feel like it's inevitable.
We're going to throw it out to the audience.
We're going to have to put all of the matchups on the web, and they're going to have to choose one for you and one for me.
So here's my move.
What's your move?
I think we might have a Team Santo and a Team Merrigan situation going on here. So I'm going to appeal to Team Merrigan. You don't have to make it bad for me, baby, right? I'm going to ask. I want Team Merrigan to show up and really lay into Santo. Something real bad.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these double bills out there that are pretty sweet.
There's some good ones out there as well.
So
there's some stuff that we could watch. It could be, as it's the holiday season, we get the gift from our audience of two really great movies because they want to hear us talk about good films.
Right.
I doubt it based on the fact that these are the same people that made me watch the Garbage Pail Kids movie. My brother-in-law is going to make me miserable.
Yeah.
And he's going to get everyone he knows to vote for the worst possible double bill.
I'm just going to remind him then while we're doing this that one of these options is the one that goes along with our Wicked Prayer episode where we forewent the whole proceedings and just declared a double bill of Crystal Force and Chuck E. Cheese in the Galaxy 5000 as a double bill. That exists. And if you remember, your family still owes me a Chuck E. Cheese pajama party that goes along with that double bill.
All right.
So I'm just saying, Crystal Forest, Chuck E. Cheese, and the Galaxy 5000 is totally an option for people. Just reminding everybody that it's out.
Well, great. This is awful. But it is what it is. I put us here. I could have just said, you're right, and just given you the point.
It was never going to happen. My ego is too great.
For that.
Going into this episode, to be real,
I think I may have put together one of my only certifiably well-reasoned double bills.
It was good.
Like this. That was actually one.
It was
so
good.
We'll see you all next time for our annual Year in Review Film Jitsu Awards.
Yes, it's the big episode. Show, baby.
This is the big show, baby. The big where one. We look back over the everything we watched in 2025, and we pick the winners in a variety of categories, everything from the Sweaty Eddies to the People's Choice Award and everything in between. And somehow play a game of, I think, kick eight, pick one or something. I don't know. There's math involved. It gets weird for the best picture. But until then, we have been your hosts. I am Jay.
And I am Mike.
And we'll see you at the year-end award show, The Jitsus.
Merry Christmas,
Happy
you
New
filthy
year.
Animal.
Merry Christmas. You filthy animal.
Daisy said that one time to a guy at a McDonald's drive-thru when she was very little, like, cause she didn't know. So she's like, Merry Christmas, you filthy animal. It was the best. That might've been the moment that I was like, me and this kid are going to be ride or die for life.